6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base.
Good afternoon. I am your host, Tim Hansel, today. I am filling in for John. John and I switched, so you're going to hear John on Wednesday and me today. But this is a public affair. I'm your host, Tim Hansel. And on today's show, we are talking about a new book about Scott Walker and the unrest during the all the stuff that went on during the actions around the budget repair bill, or Act 10. And so we're a little bit over sort of 2 years since all that happened, and so we're going to come back and talk about this book. It's called More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions, and the Fight for Wisconsin. And joining me to talk about it are the authors, Jason Stein and Patrick Marley. And I'll tell you a little bit about Jason and Patrick here, that they both cover the Capitol for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason previously covered politics for the Wisconsin State Journal and has received national recognition for his reporting. He is the past president of the Wisconsin Capitol Correspondents Association. And Patrick previously covered government for the Kenosha News. His work has been recognized by the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and the Wisconsin Newspaper Association. So Jason and Patrick, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us on.
All right, so we are going to be talking about the protests at the Capitol from 2 years ago, and we're going to be talking about this book, More Than They Bargained For. And so I imagine many of you would like to call in to talk about that, and you are welcome to do so. So let me just sort of get the numbers out for you to call if you'd like to join in our conversation. If you want to call locally, the local number is 608-251-2001, or you can call toll-free at 866-899-WORT. That's 866-899-9678. So call in if you want to reminisce about the protests, if you were there, if you have a view about what happened during that time, if you want to talk about where we are now and what we might be able to expect in the future. But here to talk to us right now are Jason and Patrick. And Jason and Patrick, you are both correspondents for the Journal Sentinel, and that your job is to sort of cover these events as journalists, and presumably you want to cover these things as objectively as possible. And that's one of the things I noticed while reading this book, is though I myself was very caught up in the activities and I was a partisan during this sort of event, I was interested to sort of read a sort of just a journalistic bare bones kind of, well, not bare bones, there's a lot of detail there, but sort of a straightforward sort of objective account. So tell us a little bit about the process of sort of putting this book together as a journalist.
Sure. You know, we were there throughout it all, covering it for the Journal Sentinel. So those were pretty long days for the two of us. We had a lot of other reporters from the Journal Sentinel who came out covering it from before it really began, up, you know, into the night, every night, sometimes overnight. And we just saw so much material there. We tried to build on that for a book. It was pretty clear pretty quickly that there was something there that could easily fill 300 pages of a book.
Right. We also, I mean, you know, in terms of doing it, we obviously were reporting everything that happened on a day-to-day basis. You know, sometimes we spent as much as almost a full 24 hours at the Capitol following the events. But then, you know, besides the, you know, thousands of interviews and reviewing all the thousands of pages of documents we did for the original reporting, we also went back and re-interviewed everyone that we could who would talk to us, who played a major role in the events. And we, you know, sort of supplemented that original round of reporting with, you know, scores of new interviews and reviews of other documents that we were able to sort of receive in the months and years that followed those original events.
Now, you mentioned that you did these sort of follow-up interviews sort of afterwards, and you said that you interviewed the people who are sort of willing to talk to you.
Right.
Are we talking about most of the major players? Did Scott Walker grant you an interview? Did Dale Schultz? You know, who did and who didn't?
I would say the majority of the major people in the book did agree to interviews many times, multiple interviews. Scott Walker was not among them. He did not grant an interview specifically for the book. However, given our day jobs, we talked to him a lot at press conferences and at sometimes in one-on-one interviews in his office or by phone. And so we were able to, over time, get a lot of our questions in for the book on that period. We also talked to people in his administration. You mentioned Dale Schultz. We did speak with him. Jason interviewed him. Many of the senators we interviewed, some key members of the assembly we interviewed, though there was probably a little more focus on the senators because the Senate Democrats had left the state for 3 weeks and were sort of the key place where the bill was stalled for so long.
I mean, I would say the only person besides the governor that we didn't get to do a specific sit-down interview with, we never really got to do a full sit-down with Capitol Police Chief Charles Tubbs, although we talked to him often, you know, while the events were going on. Other than that, there are certainly other people that we would have liked to have asked more questions to. I don't know that there's anybody else that we didn't get to ask some questions for the book.
Yeah, that's true. Jeff Fitzgerald, who's the assembly speaker at the time, we did not get to interview him as extensively as we wanted to. However, a colleague at the Journal Sentinel had an opportunity to interview him in the context of his run for the U.S. Senate, where a lot of these questions were asked, and he granted us access to his to video of that, and we were able to pull a lot from that for the book.
Okay, so definitely had a lot of information. You were there covering, you did a lot of interviews, and it's definitely, you can tell as reading through the book, how much work that you gentlemen have done. So, but let's talk a little bit about the story here. So, with the events of February, right, we're talking middle of February, it's cold, there's snow on the ground, and for many of us who aren't journalists, who don't cover this stuff, we found out about the budget repair bill as sort of a bolt from the blue, that it was very unexpected and such a surprise. And I think part of the reaction that we had to the thing, it was just given the surprising nature of it. It seemed so sort of over the top. It seemed sort of more than was necessary to deal with our financial situation and balancing the books. Now, for you two who've been covering this stuff, and for almost a decade you've been covering politics at the Capitol, how surprising was this? How did this come pretty abruptly to you as well?
I mean, it wasn't. It wasn't. I mean, it certainly wasn't surprising in the sense that, you know, the governor had a long period, as we detail in the book, of sort of conflict with unions in Milwaukee County. So, I mean, there was certainly an expectation that he would take some actions toward unions that would be negative.
That was during the time of him being
Milwaukee County executive, right. Correct. Thank you. And however, there had been some talk prior to him introducing Act 10 that he would do something of the kind. Now, that being said, it still was very, very surprising to all of us, I think, to see it in, you know, black and white. So, and it was certainly not something that was a major focus, at least the proposal that was Act 10 in the 2010 campaign. So certainly there was a lot of surprise about it.
Yeah, I might differ with you a little bit in saying that it was maybe more of a surprise than you did, in that we knew a budget repair bill was needed. There was the state's books weren't balanced. They need to fix that. So that having a bill to do that wasn't a surprise. Walker talked extensively in 2010 about making state workers pay more for their pensions and health care. So that element being included in there wasn't so surprising. But the idea of all but eliminating collective bargaining was not something he had talked about, and that did come. I mean, that was a huge move, and that came as a shock. It's also its extension to local workers. He hadn't really talked about that in the campaign. So to include teachers and highway workers, sanitation workers in it was also a big surprise.
Right. The focus was more on state workers during the campaign.
Okay. Now, the other Republicans, other than Walker, Were they surprised as well? I mean, I was sort of reading through the book that there was some, especially with the more moderate Republicans in the Senate and the Assembly, though more in the Senate, there seemed to be some surprise even amongst their ranks. Were they just sort of not included in this deliberation? Who sort of came up with the plan? Was it all Walker's idea? Was it the Legislative Council? I mean, where did it come from?
It certainly came, I mean, certainly within state government, it came from the Walker administration as opposed from lawmakers. Although very late in the process, Republican senators had a tiny bit of input in it. But, I mean, it certainly came from the governor. They were surprised by it. I mean, the book lays out that Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, who did talk to us a fair amount for the book, was surprised. So was Senator Mike Ellis, who also talked to us. I think that's very fair to say. I mean, there had been some hints back in December of 2010 after he was elected that he might go that route. But I don't think anyone ultimately was really expecting him to go that far.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Jason Stein and Patrick Marley, the two authors of the new book about Scott Walker and the budget repair bill and all the hoopla that went along with it. The book is entitled More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions, and the Fight for Wisconsin. My name is Tim Hansel, and I'm filling in for John today on A Public Affair. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. And if you'd like to call in and join our discussion with Patrick and John, please feel free to call 608-256-2001 or toll free at 866-899-WORT. That's 866-899-9678. And it looks like we do have a caller, so why don't we go to our caller? And caller, what is your name and your question?
Hi, this is Rebecca Kemble, and I write for the Progressive Magazine. And I'd like Jason and Patrick to talk about the Wisconsin Capitol Correspondents Association. I remember my first interaction with Jason was, it was really quite shocking. I entered the Capitol to report on behalf of an organization that I represent, the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives, who was interested in covering the events. And later, my writing got picked up by the Progressive, and now I write for them. But my interaction with Jason, he'll probably remember, or maybe not at the time, was surprising to me, because here was a journalist whose job it was to verify credentials and what seemed to me, based on a political basis, of people wanting to report from there. And since then, I've spent much quality time overnight in the Assembly with Jason and Patrick. But I'd just like to get their impression of the political role of the Capitol Correspondents Association, and for them to talk about what's happened to that organization since then.
Okay, thank you, Rebecca. Jason, do you want to start off with that?
Sure. Good to hear from you, Rebecca. One of the things that at that time period, I was a president of the Capitol Correspondents Association, which at that time was like a volunteer group that existed to give people credentials to get on the Senate and Assembly floor. At that time, you know, it had never been something that had ever had to deal with more than a couple dozen people. And one of the real challenges for me personally, while I was doing sort of the biggest job of my life, really, that I'd ever had, was sometimes in a given day, you might have 100 people that would come in, you know, some from Norway, from, you know, France sometimes, from Mexico, from down the street. I mean, people that you had never, ever seen, you know, would have imagined would have had an interest in Wisconsin politics suddenly did. So that was a challenging volunteer job to have when I was doing, you know, 16 and 20 hour days on my real job. So I don't actually recall seeing Rebecca come in, because I was often just, you know, in the midst of deadlines. But, you know, it was an organization that existed at that time to provide credentials on the, you know, the Senate and Assembly floor. I mean, to tell you the truth, like I think many other institutions in Wisconsin politics, it was not really prepared for the fire hose of duties and responsibilities and odd things that were cropping up at the time. So, you know, that was an event, you know, an organization existed at that time and no longer exists. Now the credentialing is done by the Senate and Assembly Sergeant Staffs. Yeah, thank you, Patrick.
Now, is that more political? I mean, I guess that was part of Rebecca's question, is it, how much does politics play into credentialing these things? I mean, I think something in the book was about somebody who was trying to get credentialed for a blog he didn't have yet.
Right, right. That's true.
I mean, that was the challenge. Certainly, the Capitol Correspondents Association was not trying to do anything political. We were just, you know, the attempt was to follow our rules and let people in who should be in and not let people in who shouldn't be let in. But it wasn't you're on the left or you're on the right. You can or can't come in based on that basis. That would be unconstitutional. None of us would support that. The sergeant's office has taken it over, and at the moment they seem to have they seem to be letting anyone in. I have not heard of cases of people having credentials rejected.
Right.
Nobody would come and complain to me, I don't think, though I do think, you know, the rumor would circulate. But so far, they seem to be letting anybody in, regardless of any ideological viewpoint.
One of the challenges that we faced with that respect was just that traditionally, that had just been to get on the Senate and Assembly floor. At a certain point, when the Capitol was shut down by the governor's administration, people started attempting to get credentials to be able to enter the Capitol because they were locked out. And so that sort of attached an importance to that process that it sort of never had before. And actually, one of the takeaways that, you know, that organization had after that is that we never really wanted to be in that position again of determining who gets in and out of the Capitol, because it's not, you know, it's not our place. It was sort of elevating you to a position that we didn't really feel was our place to hold. So
let's talk a little bit about access. I mean, one of the things about the protest were, especially after sort of the lockdown, it was hard if you were there to really get sort of access to any of the senators, to Scott Walker, to really a lot of information. It was hard to get onto the Assembly floor and the Senate. So I guess I have a question about sort of what's in the book here that those of us who were there, who were at the protests, who were marching around and, you know, listening to the bagpipes and the drums and all these sorts of things, what are some of the things that we missed that maybe you two had privy to in covering for the Sentinel and as your role as journalists?
Well, you know, one thing to keep in mind is it wasn't just ordinary citizens who had trouble getting access to the Capitol at times. We, you know, there were legislators who couldn't get in the building on session days, who had to come in through a tunnel or come in through a window to get into the building.
Legislators through a window?
Yes, legislators through a window. Absolutely. There's some mention of that in the book. There was one Representative Milroy at one point was tackled by a police officer as he tried to get into the Capitol. So we had difficulty at times getting in, but we did have a unique level of access. I mean, there were many other reporters who were similarly situated, that we were in the room for the conference committee, for instance, a place where only 20 members of the public were allowed in. We were on the Senate or Assembly floor for every major action. There were a few times where we didn't have someone from the paper on the Assembly floor during the 62-hour debate, but for all of the key moments, we were there. And, you know, we had a chance to interview the governor at least once and probably a couple of times in his office during the protests.
Yeah, a couple of times.
We were at all of the press conferences. So there were things that people would have seen in the news at the time but wouldn't have had access to. And in addition, we had a lot of chances to go back into secured areas to talk to Republican senators about what they were thinking, you know, in the moment, how they were trying to lure the Democrats back.
Yeah, I mean, I would say really because Wisconsin I was there for all these official events. So, you know, I would say what the book would offer a reader would be more about what was happening behind the scenes, whether it's, you know, the governor talking to Senate Republicans, what the Obama campaign told, President Obama's campaign told recall organizers or, you know, Wisconsin Democrats rather, prior to the Walker recall taking place, things like that. You know, the what were Senate Democrats telling each other as they were, you know, trying to decide what to do in Illinois when they were down there to try to block Act 10 from being passed. So, I mean, to the extent that we can offer something, I think it's in those areas.
And of course, some of the things Jason's talking about, we weren't physically present. We weren't there when Obama's campaign manager met with Mike Tate and other people from the labor community. But we were able to reconstruct those events with extensive interviews.
So you did interview Walker, though. Is that correct?
Well, yes. Not specifically for the book, but we had many times to talk to him over the last 2 years.
So I guess I do have a question, and even outside of the interviews, what was the main argument for Walker for doing what he did? Was it the sort of stuff that we heard in his addresses? Was it purely about, you know, getting the state's sort of financial books in order? And if so, why the collective bargaining, right? Why was that sort of so central to it, especially when he would go on media and he didn't seem to mention it, right? He would talk about, oh, we want the workers to pay their fair share and we're broke and stuff like that. And he was very careful not really to mention the collective bargaining stuff. So why was that stuff there in the first place?
I mean, I think it's true that he did, you know, he did stick more in his public talks to the benefits. You know, I think he's very disciplined in terms of the message that he sends out. So I don't think, you know, when there were once or twice when we interviewed him in his office right before he came out and spoke, you know, at a more public press conference. And I think, you know, his remarks would be very similar, sometimes even identical. You know, his argument was that there needed to be certainty, that collective bargaining allowed too much uncertainty in the process. Now, you know, obviously there still is some, you know, uncertainty to this day as we continue to have lawsuits over Act 10 that have not finished, at least in state court. So, I mean, you know, that blade can cut two ways. And many people would differ with his, you know, with his stance on that. But that was certainly what he said, and he said it consistently. I don't believe he ever offered in interviews with us anything different from what he was saying in other public venues, or we certainly would have reported it at the time.
Right. One of the things that he would go back to when publicly he would talk about the benefits and the health care as being the things that were the cost savings. But if you pressed him on collective bargaining, he would contend that there was a hidden cost to collective bargaining, that those agreements govern who gets overtime and when, so that correctional officers or anybody could argue that the most senior employee got the first chance at overtime, which would be the highest paid employees, that the teachers union would put provisions in its contract to use WEA Trust, which the Republicans say has higher healthcare costs. And so they would say that there are these other elements to having collective bargaining agreements that drive up costs for taxpayers.
Now, I would like to return to that idea because it is 2 years later and we've had some of these cuts have gone into effect and these supposed savings are supposed to happen. But before we get to that, I would like to ask a question just about, and this may be difficult to answer, but the sincerity of these individuals, right? There are these sort of two pictures that we get. One is from sort of supporters of Scott Walker, that here's a man who's sort of standing up for what he believes is right. He's doing the right thing. He's making the tough, difficult choices and trying to get the state out of its sort of financial mess and not resorting to the sort of budgetary trickery that had been going on in sort of past years in order to deal with budget shortfalls and whatnot. And then on the other hand, there's the view of Scott Walker as being just sort of this craven politician, that he's going after collective bargaining because he knows that's going to hurt the Democratic base, right, that generates money for the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. obviously. And so, like I said, it's hard to sort of read people's minds, but did you have a sense of what Scott Walker was more like? I mean, maybe a mix of the two, Jason?
I mean, I think, you know, just speaking in general, I think when you look at politicians, I mean, they look at areas where they can find some common ground between the politics and the policy that they're looking for, right? So, that's not just Scott Walker, that's in general. So, you know, certainly there was this aspect of the bill that provided savings that he was looking for in the budget, and there was an aspect of the bill that, you know, was undoubtedly damaging to one of Democrats' key allies or key backers. And there was certainly, you know, concern about how that would be perceived even by Republicans. So, I mean, you know, one of Scott Fitzgerald, that's the Senate Majority Leader, one of his concerns about the bill when it was first shared with him before it became publicly announced was that it would look like an attack on Democrats, or attack on, you know, an attack on, you know, a political ally of Democrats. And so that was one of the arguments that Senate Republicans made for not simply doing away with most public employee unions, which was Scott Walker's original plan. You know, ironically, that change that they made didn't really change the way it was perceived by Democrats. But, I mean, that was certainly a concern that some Republicans had. And since we've been talking about concerns that Republicans had, it's worth mentioning that there were, you know, other Republicans, particularly in the Assembly, who wanted Scott Walker to go even further, to do something like right to work that would have, you know, that's been done in Michigan since now, and would have had an impact not just on public employee unions, but private sector unions as well.
You're good, Pat?
I'm good. Jason said it well.
All right. Well, if you're just joining us, you are listening to WORT 89.9. Listener-sponsored community radio, and this is A Public Affair with me, Tim Hansel, today, filling in for John. John's going to be in next Wednesday, or this Wednesday, I should say. And we are talking with Jason Stein and Patrick Marley about their new book that just came out, More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions and the Fight for Wisconsin. Jason and Patrick are journalists with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and they both covered all the events of the budget repair bill and all the stuff that went around and on during that time. And we must admit, for those of us who were there, a lot of things happened that were unprecedented, things that we just never really expected to see and were surprised by. So I guess one of my questions for you two is, what were your sort of most surprising events during those weeks of covering this stuff? I imagine a lot of it was unprecedented for you as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Patrick. I think, I mean, unprecedented things were happening every day. That's what made the situation so unbelievable. For me, this is kind of obscure, but the one that stunned me the most, or one of the ones that stunned me the most, was when the bill was passed, signed into law. Immediately there was a complaint from the DA here in Dane County, alleging that the conference committee had violated the open meetings law. Went to the judge. The judge found initially that it was likely to succeed, so enjoined the law from being published. And so publishing a law at that time had this sort of Byzantine process where the Secretary of State designates the date that it happens, and then the Legislative Reference Bureau publishes it on the date that's been dictated by the Secretary of State. So the Secretary of State, Doug La Follette, rescinded his order on when to publish the law, and the Legislative Reference Bureau on that day suddenly published the law with this bizarre footnote saying, notwithstanding that we don't have an official date, we're publishing this. And as it came out later, the Senate Majority Leader, Scott Fitzgerald, had met with the Reference Bureau and told them that he thought they had a legal duty to publish the law, and they consulted with the Attorney General's office, who also told them this. So this, you know, the law has been enjoined, and then all of a sudden it's published, and we were sitting in the press room just puzzling over this, and everyone turned to Dick Wheeler, who, you know, founded the Wheeler Report and was the dean of the press room. He passed away last year, or 2011. Everybody turned to him because all of these legislative machinations, Dick was the guy who understands, you know, how to stop a third reading and all these things. Dick, what does this mean? And he said, well, I don't know. And then we knew we were way over the rainbow at that point if he didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, Patrick is one of the few people that can explain how that all happened. Whenever I write that, I have to go to him and say, now, did I get this right? And usually I haven't quite gotten it right. You know, there were a lot of odd moments. I mean, there was one moment where I walked into the press room and asked, did anybody see which way Jesse Jackson went? That was like the day of his first visit. So that was something I'd never, words that I never thought I would quite find myself saying. I mean, I think, besides just the massive size of the crowds, which really surprised everyone. I mean, we knew that it would be a very, very big fight over the bill as soon as we saw it. But, you know, you sort of relate everything to your own experience, right? So we thought it would be a big fight in the meaning of what had been a big fight previously at the Capitol. And it turned out to be, you know, an order of magnitude bigger than that. You know, maybe besides the Senate Democrats going to Illinois, I think maybe ultimately, though, the most surprising thing is that you actually have this physical confrontation between two Supreme Court justices over a piece, a decision, which was ultimately over Act 10. I think that by far to me was the most incredible thing and something that I would have never predicted.
And you're talking about Prosser and...
Right. So Justice David Prosser and Justice Ann Walsh Bradley from two of the conservative and liberal wings of the court.
Well, it looks like we have some more callers, so why don't we go to them. Caller, what is your name and your question or comment?
Can you hear me? Yeah.
Yeah, hey, we got
you. Thanks for the coverage. Also, parallel to this, since budgeting and money seems to be so important, I didn't get a lot of extra feedback on how they lost $50 million at the Wisconsin Economic Development Fund, and supposedly they gave twice as much money to some of these corporate donors as they were supposed to, and didn't really get much media coverage. That's the way kind of the politics works, you know. Damn, thanks.
Hi, Brent. I'll toot my own horn and say that I was the first journalist to report about loans not being tracked at the Wisconsin Economic Development Corp. That is the agency that Scott Walker created as a, and along with lawmakers, as a successor to the State Department of Commerce. There were roughly $50 million in loans that were not systematically tracked. These are loans that, you know, they've been given out to businesses by the state, mostly by the department, old Department of Commerce, over the past several years. And then when the WEDC, the WEDC came into being, they stopped systematically tracking those loans. It doesn't exactly mean that they didn't ever do any follow-up on any of them, but they no longer were keeping a centralized, I guess, database of what was happening with these taxpayer-funded loans. And of the ones that were late, it was in the neighborhood of $12 million. I know I certainly wrote, an easy 10 articles on that since maybe I think it was October or so that we first reported on that. None of the money itself has been lost, quote-unquote. It's all there. There may have been cases, though, where taxpayers missed out on a chance to recover money from an overdue loan that because we as a state were not necessarily timely in taking the kinds of legal actions that a creditor takes when a debtor owes the money and has stopped paying it back.
All right. Thank you, Jason. So let me ask a couple questions about the events during that time. One of them that was really interesting to me was the flight to Illinois from the 14 senators, the 14 Democratic senators, and just the details of why they had they're trying to do things to sort of block this. They were trying to figure out sort of what they needed to do in order to sort of keep this from being passed, because they certainly didn't have the votes to keep it from being passed, and we don't have a filibuster system like at the federal level. So just what were the details here? Just the a little bit of the, you know, just the procedures that they were sort of considering and what sort of allowed them to stall it the way that it did.
Right. So the Wisconsin Constitution says that if you have a bill that's defined as a fiscal bill, essentially if it spends money or raises taxes or incurs debt, that you have to have a 3/5 majority in each house present. You just have a simple majority to pass it, but the 3/5 has to be present. So in the Senate, 33 members, that means you have to have 20 senators there. As it happened, the Republicans had a 19-14 majority, which is a really big majority, but it's not 3/5. And so the Walker introduced his bill on a we found out about it on a Thursday. It was formally announced on a Friday. The plan was to have it passed within a week. So it was to come up that next Thursday for a vote. In the meantime, this incredible massive protest shows up, and the Democrats, you know, are feeling outgunned because they're in the minority in both houses, but, you know, their spirits are up because of this outpouring of support for their position. And now it comes to the morning of the vote. It's passed the Joint Finance Committee, and they're really out of options. I mean, there's nothing to be done to stop it other than to try to talk on the floor as long as possible. And so Mark Miller, who's a minority leader at the time, told everybody to meet early that morning at the Democratic Party headquarters, which is just down the street from the Capitol, and he laid it out. Here's an option. They had researched it prior to any of this happening and said, if we all leave now, we can halt this thing for the moment and hope that the public pressure will build and that Republicans will compromise. And it was, you know, once they got down to Illinois, there were many different opinions about the strategy and what the means to get back was and the terms of any kind of deal should be. But at that moment, everybody was in agreement. Yeah, this is it. We got to do this. And so 12 of the 14 were present. Bob Jauch arrived just after they'd made the decision and said, okay, I guess we're going to Illinois. And then they called Tim Cullen, who was the other one who wasn't there, told him. And he agreed to leave as well. Because all 14 had to stay the whole time away. If even one of them came back to the Capitol, it was over.
Right. I mean, the only other thing I'd say there is one of the new things that is in the book is that Mark Miller's office actually started looking into that possibility months before they actually left in a real basic way. When Scott Walker first floated the idea in December 2010 about doing something like Act 10, they started kicking around ideas, well, how would we stop something like that? And then the day that Walker actually introduced the bill publicly, or, you know, unveiled it, which would have been Friday, February 11th, they actually sent a request, Miller's office, to legislative attorneys to see if this tactic would work. And so by Monday or Tuesday of that next week, a couple days before they left, they had this document from nonpartisan legislative attorneys saying, if you go to Illinois, it'll block the bill. But it was saying that if there aren't, 14 senators present, then the bill couldn't be passed.
Right. So, and actually that story was kind of interesting because one of the senators, I think it was Cullen, had to go to the Capitol before he could leave. Is that correct? And then he was just sort of barely got missed when they did the call the floor?
So he's from Janesville. He lives in Janesville. And as it happened, Bill Bablich, a former state Supreme Court justice and state senator, had died. And Bablich and Cullen were longtime friends. And Bill had been sick for some time. And Cullen had agreed with the family that he would relate to the Capitol Press Corps that Bill Bablich had died, and what, you know, the arrangements were. And so he was heading back to the Capitol, arranging this sort of this press conference, or just a sort of a small get-together in his office to tell the press this. And Mark Miller calls him and says, hey, we're leaving the state. And he said, well, I've got to go to the Capitol. And, you know, that made Mark Miller a little nervous. don't get caught. And so Cullen actually talked to Senate President Mike Ellis and said, I'm going to go to the press, and then I want to get out of here before you do a quorum call. And Ellis essentially let that happen. It was a pretty amazing moment.
So he allowed the defection to occur, knowing what that meant. Is that correct?
That's true. Right. Yes.
However, no one really knew what that defection meant.
Okay.
In that, everyone, Democrats and Republicans, seem to universally believe that the their exit from the state would have been a matter of hours or days, not a matter of weeks.
Yeah, that's a good point.
If you're just joining us, you are listening to Jason Stein and Patrick Marley talk about their new book, More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions, and the Fight for Wisconsin. This is A Public Affair, and I'm your host, Tim Hansel, filling in for John. Looks like we do have a caller on the line. So, caller, what is your name and your question or comment?
My name is Jeff. My question is, can you analyze the progressive nastiness in feeling that the Democrats sucked the energy out of the recall, including the White House, where the president wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Thanks, Jeff.
So you're right, the president didn't touch it by the time it came to the recall. If you remember, right before the recall, President Obama was in, I think he made 3 or 4 stops in Illinois and Minnesota. So it's like they flew over Wisconsin, but didn't come here for the recall. As we mentioned earlier, the president's campaign manager, Jim Messina, met months before the recall got started to express skepticism with the head of the state Democratic Party and labor leaders. They were concerned about whether a recall could be successful and its impact on the president's campaign in Wisconsin. He was told at that meeting and seemed to understand that there was no stopping this recall, that that if the party and the labor unions weren't involved, that there was a grassroots that was there that was ready to, you know, use the infrastructure they had in place to make a recall happen. Now, President Obama is a politically savvy guy, so you know, there were problems with the recall in that there was for the supporters of the recall, in that there turned out to be a significant number of voters who didn't like what Governor Walker had done, but did not think it was a recallable offense. And David Axelrod was recently interviewed in, there's a story in Sunday's Journal Sentinel where he talks about many aspects of his career, but he talks about the recall and about the skepticism he had of the recall. So there was a definite concern, and even in the early days from the state Democratic Party, there were concerns about the strategy and the timing, but they quickly concluded, maybe not so quickly, but over the weeks and months concluded that this thing was happening no matter what.
Yeah, David Axelrod, obviously being Obama's senior campaign strategist. I think that's there. I mean, the only other thing that I would say is, because the president did not get involved in Wisconsin, with the exception of one comment he made to a Milwaukee TV station for an interview that was about something else, the left never really had a national figure speaking for them in this recall. On the other side, there wasn't a national figure from outside Wisconsin that was speaking out for conservatives, but there was Walker, and by the time this thing was done, he had sort of become a national figure for conservatives. So, and, you know, that was certainly one thing that was very different about the two sides in this conflict, is one had one person that they could look to as their spokesperson. You know, the other side had, you know, at times, you know, tens of thousands of people on the ground, but not that one recognizable figure.
And it was, you're talking about the grassroots nature of the recall effort. One of the stories that you sort of detail in the book is about how the recall website got started. And
right.
So if you just talk a little bit about that, I thought that story was very interesting.
Oh, thanks. I do agree with you. It was very interesting to learn more about Michael Brown, who founded United Wisconsin, is an interesting guy. He's somebody who ran for the assembly actually against a Democrat as an independent I guess it would have been 2010.
Or was it 2008?
We'll hedge on that. But I mean, you know, the bottom line being that he'd actually run against a Democrat as an independent. He didn't get anywhere. I think he'd raised $50 or something, and it was all from himself. So I mean, that sort of gives you a sense of it was not a big time campaign by any means. But you know, he was a political outsider and not even really exactly a Democrat. And he started, you know, but he is an internet marketer, so that's, he's savvy to social media and marketing, and he was able to really, with no more startup costs and sort of his own time, create this website that went viral, United Wisconsin, and ended up, you know, becoming a movement that, with a lot of work, you know, beyond Brown, who eventually withdrew from that effort, you know, was able to gather, you know, more than 900,000 recall signatures, which is, I mean, you know, obviously the recall didn't succeed, but I'm not sure anyone thought it would have been possible to even gather that many signatures. Mm-hmm. So it was certainly kind of a remarkable story.
And to be clear, I mean, Brown's efforts just absolutely stunned the Democratic establishment. The state Democratic Party is sitting there scratching its head. You know, they do this professionally full time. They've been doing it for decades. And here comes this guy nobody's heard of with no budget, no fundraising ability.
And a website.
And he's got this website, and all of a sudden he's got hundreds of thousands of people's names of, you know, many of whom weren't on Democratic lists. They couldn't believe that it had happened.
Now, and it's worth noting that, you know, both Mike and the Democratic Party, I think, would say that it wasn't just about him or something magical that he did. It was more about the energy that came around that bill. I mean, nevertheless, I mean, you know, he is the one that found a way to harness it.
Excellent. It looks like we do have another caller, so why don't we go to that person. And caller, what's your name and your question or comment?
Hi, my name is Eric, and I wanted to comment because I just heard a few minutes ago someone say that Wisconsin people did not feel there were any offenses committed that were serious enough to dump Walker. And I think there is likely some people like that, but I feel that totally disregards the awful job of messaging that was done to educate people as to why Walker needed to go down. And say when they're in the process of gathering upwards of 1 million signatures, they had no flyers and no information for people as to why this is a good idea, and for all the many, many people who walked up in front of the libraries and public sidewalks and so on, who said, well, this is new to me, I'm not sure yet, so no, I don't think I want to sign, but I'm thinking about it. They were handed nothing. Mm. And as usual, this is the Democratic Party weakness. And the answer I got when I asked them at the time about it was, oh, well, it's all on the website, all those 10 reasons that you wrote up why that should be handed out to people as we gather the signatures.
Right.
That's all on our website. Like, right. Oh, so we have an entire state of political junkies who go to websites? No, they watch Fox News TV and right. Outside of Madison.
Well, thank you very much, Eric. That's a good point. Well, yeah, Patrick, would you like to respond?
Yeah, I guess the point I was trying to make about the voters who felt that they didn't like what Walker had done but didn't think that it was something that warranted recall, that might not be, you know, those people in and of themselves aren't a majority of the state because there are many people who think what Walker did was a good thing, and they support him on that basis. But there was, you know, all you need is a few percentage points of people who feel that way, who say, I'm not sure about Act 10. I don't like Act 10, but I don't think that that's enough, you know, that you should commit a crime or be guilty of malfeasance to be recalled. I mean, that's a lot in a political election, in a campaign. So that was the problem. As for the messaging issue, you know, people are welcome to make their criticism of why the recall succeeded or failed. But, you know, they did not have a problem gathering signatures. They right. did. They were able to find about 1 million people who signed recall petitions. And, you know, I think those people would say that they had, you know, the thing was in the news so much that people had very firm opinions about Scott Walker by the time the recall signature gathering was happening. And if they handed a clipboard to somebody and they said they were unsure about it, that person who was volunteering their time to collect signatures would be happy to inform them why they thought that he should be recalled.
You know, the one other factor I think that another factor that's out there is there was obviously quite a bit of tension and conflict between the camps that supported Kathleen Falk, former mm-hmm. Dane County mm-hmm. executive, and Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett as the Democratic opponent to Walker. And, you know, clearly that didn't help the process of trying to recall the governor for his opponents.
And it was the case, you detail a little bit in the book, that there was a candidate sort of preferred by the unions, and that may have played a role in this as well. Is that correct?
Right. I mean, yeah, Kathleen was clearly preferred by the unions, and they spent in the neighborhood of $4 million, $4.5 million, supporting her. And obviously, she did not win the primary. Tom Barrett did, but when he emerged from the primary, he had for a period of time, not much money, and you know, wasn't able. He wasn't able to immediately kind of get on the airwaves. It took him some time to do some fundraising and get back up. So, I mean, you know, it's always very difficult to say why one thing goes one way and another thing goes one way in politics. But, I mean, that is one thing that I think in hindsight was not helpful to the Democrats' cause.
Well, it looks like we just have a few minutes left here. So let's sort of wrap things up with sort of where we're at today, right? The conclusion of your book, I think the latest thing that I saw sort of in the book was January 13th or something along that line. So you're really sort of writing this right up until the end. So where, I don't know, just from your own perspective, sort of where are we at now with regards to this whole issue, and how have things changed, and how have you changed in, you know, this whole process? And just a couple minutes.
What we were able to get into the book that happened in January was significant. It was the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals upheld Act 10 in its entirety.
The federal court.
So the federal court has found no legal problems with Act 10, no constitutional problems with Act 10. The fights continue in state court, and I think will for some time. A Dane County judge has ruled parts of the law violate the state constitution. That's before a court of appeals. And to highlight just how divided the state is, the parties can't agree at this point as to the effect of the lower court's decision, with one side saying that it has a limited effect as to which parties are affected by it, and the other side saying that it applies to all local government employees and that they should be able to negotiate not as fully with as much freedom as they did prior to Act 10, but certainly more than Act 10 was included. So I think that the most important thing going forward is what happens in the courts. It's clearly going to be taken up to the state Supreme Court on this case and possibly others. And so it will be months and perhaps years before the legal status of Act 10 is really known.
Yeah. You know, the governor is obviously has become a conservative star who's, you know, making some movement that might suggest he'd like to run for president. You know, we have, you know, within state and local government, things like voucher schools or sometimes called school choice by their supporters, you know, that, you know, including in Madison, that proposal's on the table in the legislature. And certainly, you have a weakened state teachers union, fighting against that. I think for me personally, what I took away from the entire experience was sort of a new understanding or appreciation for what citizen involvement means in politics. I feel like having had tens of thousands of protesters in my workplace for an extended period of time, you know, because we both work out of the state capitol, I think it gives me a better understanding of both the Tea Party movement, of the labor movement, of kind of citizen movements in general, and also I think of the very real challenges that our country faces as we try and deal with some significant financial challenges at a time when we're more polarized than we've been in a long time as a nation, as a state, and as a nation.
Well, that definitely feels like one of the effects, right? That we've sort of all gone to our corners, and it's been a lot more difficult to have sort of meaningful and constructive conversations about a lot of these issues, and that is sort of a shameful sort of aspect, I think, of all of it. Well, gentlemen, the book was very interesting, and I mean there was so much there that we just couldn't get to all of it, and we've sort of come to the end of our hour. But I do want to mention a couple things. One, that the book was just published, right? The publication date was the 11th of April. And it's published by the University of Wisconsin Press.
Right.
And I guess there's a couple of events that we want to make our listeners aware of. First of all, just coming up here relatively soon, in about a week, April 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Memorial Union, you will be giving a talk and a reading at LitFest.
That's right.
And then also on, I think I have it here, Saturday, May 4th at 2 p.m. at the Goodman South Madison Library, you'll be doing the same there, and you'll be listening.
Yeah, typically we do a short reading, we make a few comments, and we welcome any kinds of questions, and usually the audiences have lots of questions.
And we'll sign a few books as well.
Fantastic. Well, you, Jason Stein, Patrick Marley, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for talking about your book, More Than They Bargained For. I am Tim Hansel. Your engineer for today was Dace, and on the phones was Dean. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for doing that.
Thank you. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions.